Appreciate the good prayer that Brother Virgil has offered, and I need your prayers while I stand before you this morning. Would you turn with me, please, to Matthew chapter 18? And I'd like to begin reading. We'll begin reading in verse 12 of Matthew chapter 18. Jesus says, "How think ye, if a man have 100 sheep, and one of them be gone astray, doth he not leave the 99 and goeth into the mountains and seeketh that which is gone astray? And if so be that he find it, verily I say unto you, he rejoiceth more of that sheep than of the 99 which went not astray. Even so, it is not the will of your Father which is in heaven that one of these little ones should perish." This is an illustration that Jesus uses on more than one occasion. And this is, I'll continue reading after this, but I just want to look at these first few verses at first. But this is an illustration that Jesus uses on a number of occasions to describe how it is that God deals with his sheep that go astray. This is also the same language he uses over in Luke chapter 15 when he is also talking about how the Son of Man has come to seek and save that which was lost. And in Luke chapter 15, not only does Jesus give a parable involving a man that had 100 sheep and one of them went astray, but he continues there and talks about a woman that had 10 coins and she lost one of those 10 coins. And searched the whole house until she found it. And then he continues in that very same parable and talks about a man that had two sons. And one of those sons wasted his inheritance on riotous living. And we know that as the story sometimes referred to as the prodigal son. But in Matthew chapter 18, the only part of that parable that he mentions here is the part that concerns the 100 sheep. And Jesus says that this man had 100 sheep. And he says, if a man have 100 sheep and one of them be gone astray, doth he not leave the 99 and goeth into the mountains and seek that which is gone astray? Jesus poses this as kind of a rhetorical question and says, well, wouldn't anybody, if you had 100 sheep and one of them went missing, wouldn't you obviously go and leave the 99 to go look for the one that was lost? And kind of irony of that question is that they wouldn't have. No. Shepherd would have left 99 sheep untended to go search for one. That's not how shepherds would handle that situation. Elder Gary Hall, most of you know, is a veterinarian, and he said that Georgia preachers, more than preachers in any other part of the country, love to preach about the sheep passages of the Bible. And he says that Georgia preachers really shouldn't preach about sheep that much because we don't know what we're talking about. He said there's not a lot of sheep in Georgia. He said years ago when he was first starting off as a veterinarian, there was some sort of a epidemic that came through and wiped out half the sheep in the state of Georgia. And he said 6 sheep died. So we don't have the relation to sheep the way that people in other parts of the world and other parts of the country have, and certainly the people Jesus was talking to. But if the idea here is that for us, it wouldn't make any sense to leave 99 sheep unattended to go look for one that was lost, because by the time you got back from searching for the one that was lost, those other 99 would very likely have been scattered and gone 99 different directions, and they would be lost too, and it would be nearly impossible to get all 99 of those back together, and you'd probably lose a very large number of them. And by the way, the one you went looking for might have, you know, might already be dead. The wolves might have gotten it. So from a human standpoint, it wouldn't make any sense for a shepherd to leave 99 sheep untended in the wilderness to go look for one that was lost. But the way Jesus poses this question is to point out how different the way that God seeks after his children. He says the Son of Man has come to save that which was lost. In Luke's account, Luke chapter 15, he says the Son of Man has come to seek and to save that which was lost. And I've always loved that phrase that he uses in Luke's account, because he didn't say that the Son of Man came to seek to save. It's not that Jesus came into the world to seek to save that which was lost. It's not that he came to make a good attempt at it, but he came to seek and to save. And I can assure you this morning that Jesus Christ came and he sought that which was lost, and he saved that which was lost. He saved everyone that he came seeking after. But the point is that, first of all, even though I believe that the elect family of God is just a massive number of people, I think it's in the billions of people. It's a number that no man can number. It's a number that the Bible sometimes compares to the number of stars in the sky. That's how God described it to Abraham. It's sometimes referred to as being as innumerable as the sands of the seashore. But even though the family of God is made up of countless billions of God's elect children, what this passage tells us is that God loves every one of those children as if you were the only one to love. He loves every last one of his elect family as if they were the only child he had to love. And so much so that the Son of Man was willing to go out and leave the 99 in the wilderness to go and to seek and to save that one that was lost. And he says that when he finds it, he says that he rejoiceth more of that sheep than of the 99 which went not astray. Even so, it is not the will of your Father which is in heaven that one of these little ones should perish. Then in verse 15, he continues this same line of thinking, but he gets a little more practical in the instructions about how we're to deal with offenses. Really, the whole 18th chapter of Matthew, if we had started reading from verse 1, if we were to back up and read from verse 1, the whole chapter is about dealing with offenses. And in verse 15, Jesus says, "Moreover, if thy brother shall trespass against thee, go and tell him his fault between thee and him alone. If he shall hear thee, thou hast gained thy brother. But if he will not hear thee, then take with thee one or two more, that in the mouth of two or three witnesses every word may be established. And if he shall neglect to hear them, tell it to the church. But if he neglect to hear the church, let him be unto thee as an heathen man and a publican. So in these three verses, Jesus tells us how it is that we're to deal with trespasses between two church members, and how we're to deal with that type of trouble in the church. And by the way, anytime I normally don't preach on this passage when I'm visiting another church, but the few times that I have, I always like to preface it by saying that I don't have any reason to suspect that there's any type of trouble like this going on here. But it's always good to preach about these things and to make sure people understand these things before trouble starts.
Yeah.
Because when trouble does happen, when there are trespasses against a brother, and there begins to be conflict in the church, by then it's really it sometimes can be too late to preach and teach on these things, because then people are already, they've already got their hackles up, they're already digging their heels in, and sometimes people don't want to hear anything about it because they're already upset. So it's good to teach on these things when the church is at peace and when these problems are not going on. But I always like to preface that, because there was one time that I preached on this really at the prompting of a pastor. I was visiting another church, and earlier that week, the pastor of that church had asked me some questions about this passage. When I visited that church, I said, well, I've had this passage on my mind because your pastor was asking me some questions about Matthew chapter 18. And I should have clarified, the reason he was asking me questions was because there was a young preacher in another state who was asking him about it, and he had heard me preach on it a few years earlier. But I didn't clarify that, and so I noticed the people began looking around at each other, because I think that they thought that their pastor had been asking me about it, because they thought there must be some problem going on at that church. So all that to say, I believe it's important to teach on these things when the church is at peace, before a situation like this arises. And I don't have any reason to suspect that there's any problem like this here at Macedonia. But Jesus says that if thy brother shall trespass against thee, go and tell him his fault between thee and him alone. Now, what Jesus is talking about here is dealing with a trespass that is between two individuals in the same church. He's not talking about public sins or public offenses. There are other places in the Bible where that type of thing is dealt with. In the 1 Corinthian letter, Paul tells the church there how to deal with a gross case of adultery, where it was out in the open, where it was widely reported in the public. This was something that everybody knew about. It was going on out in the open, and it was widely reported to the Apostle Paul. That's not the kind of situation that Jesus is talking about here in Matthew chapter 18. If a church member goes out and gets arrested for public drunkenness, and it's a known fact, and it's an open public offense, that's not exactly what Jesus is dealing here with in Matthew chapter 18. This is talking about if a brother trespasses against you. This is talking about a personal trespass between two brothers, between two church members. And it's also not talking about, the word trespass here indicates that this is more than just somebody said something that rubbed you the wrong way. You know, if that's what Jesus was talking about, if it was just something that was just a minor slight, you know, we ought to forgive those things and do what Paul said in 1 Corinthians chapter 13 when he said that charity suffereth long and it thinketh no evil. In other words, if somebody says something that maybe rubs you the wrong way, or you might could interpret it one of two ways, assume the best and don't make a brother an offender for a word. But this is talking about a trespass, not just something where somebody did something or said something that irritated you. This is talking about a trespass against somebody else. And he says, if thy brother shall trespass against thee, go and tell him his fault between thee and him alone. Notice that the responsibility is on the person who was trespassed against. Jesus didn't say that the brother who trespassed against somebody else is supposed to be the first one to go and apologize. Jesus says that if you have been trespassed against, it's your responsibility to go to the one who trespassed and tell him his fault between thee and him alone. And there's probably a lot of reasons for that, but for one thing, probably the main reason I can think of is that person may not even realize that they have trespassed against you. That person may have not intended to anything at all. It may be a big misunderstanding, and you might be carrying a grudge against that person for something they don't even realize they've done. But I've heard people who had the attitude that so-and-so did something to me or said something to me, and I'm not going back over there, and I'm not going to have anything to do with them until he comes and apologizes to me. Well, you know, he may not even realize he has done something or said something that has offended you so badly. That's why Jesus says, if thy brother trespasses against you, then it's your responsibility to go and tell him his fault between thee and him alone. I remember when I think about this verse, I think about a church meeting I was at probably 12, 15 years ago. And there was a preacher there from several states away. He had never been to this meeting before. And this was my first time meeting this preacher. I had heard about him. I knew him by name, but I had never met him before. And I noticed the whole meeting, he was kind of off by himself, kind of standing off, you know, in the corner, or kind of standing outside under a tree, had his arms crossed. You know, his body language was very, very standoffish. And so I didn't even go speak to him because he looked like he wanted to be left alone. And later on, years later, when I got to know this preacher a lot better and got to be friends with him, he was talking about that meeting, and he said, I went to that meeting, I had been so looking forward to it because I had heard about this meeting, and I had wanted to go for years, and I went, and do you know that those were the most unfriendly people. Nobody had it. Nobody came up and introduced themselves. Nobody said anything to me. And knowing him as well as I do now, I told him, I said, well, I remember that meeting, and you looked like you didn't want anybody to you know, come within 10 feet of you. But the idea, my point by telling that story is that sometimes people can offend other people without even knowing it. And that's why Jesus says that if somebody has trespassed against you, that you don't need to wait on them to come apologize. You go and tell them their fault between thee and him alone. And that's before you tell anybody else about it. In fact, if somebody trespasses against us, we don't have any business talking to anybody else about it until after we have gone and talked to that person alone between just the two of us. Yeah. You know, if you come up to me sometime and say, well, so-and-so offended me or trespassed against me, and they did such and so to me. What do you think I ought to do about it? Or can you believe he did that? Or can you believe she said that? The first thing I'm going to say is, well, what did they say when you went and talked to them about it? Because if somebody has trespassed against me, I don't have any business talking to anybody else about it until after I have already gone and talked to them between me and them alone. And Jesus says, if he shall hear thee, thou hast gained thy brother. That's the purpose. That's the goal here. Is to restore fellowship, to gain our brother. You know, I've heard people who had the attitude, if somebody has trespassed against them, they it's almost like, well, we've got to get through step one in order to get to step two, in order to get to step three and bring it before the church. There, in some places in the past, that's been the attitude. It's like, well, we've got to go through the checklist in order to bring this problem before the church. I've got to go talk to my brother so that I can then move on to step two and bring two or three witnesses. And we've got to go through that in order to go to step three and bring it before the church. As if the purpose is to go through this checklist in order to bring it before the church. Well, that's not the purpose here. The purpose is to try to keep it out of the church, to try to resolve problems so they don't have to come to the attention of the church, so that nobody else even has to know about it. The idea is to resolve the problem, and Jesus says that if he shall hear thee, thou hast gained thy brother. That's the purpose here. That's what we want to happen. But Jesus says, but if he will not hear thee, then take with thee one or two more, that in the mouth of two or three witnesses, every word may be established. Jesus says that if you can't resolve the problem between just the two of you, he says, then go and take two or three witnesses. He didn't say go get two or three people that you can rally up to your side and go ahead and get them on your side of the dispute before you go so that you can team up on them. These are supposed to be two or three wise, trustworthy people that can act as a witness so that it's not just your word against that other person's word, that you've got two or three trustworthy people who can be witnesses to what's happening, and that if they need to step in, they're wise enough that they can help try to resolve that situation. But the main purpose is that they can be witnesses, not that they can just be somebody on your team. The purpose, again, is not to win. The purpose is to gain thy brother. And he says, if he shall hear, he says that in the mouth of two or three witnesses, every word may be established. And if he shall neglect to hear them, tell it to the church. Now, again, that's really the last resort. The idea is to keep it out of the church, to keep it from having to trouble the church in the first place. But if it comes to that, if he won't hear those two or three witnesses, he says then, tell it to the church. And one thing that was pointed out to me one time is Jesus doesn't even tell the church here exactly what to do. He doesn't even tell the church exactly how to handle this situation, because the church has some discretion to handle that situation maybe a few different ways depending on the situation. Now, there's some situations that are very clear, black and white. If that person is unrepentant, in fact, he'll go on to tell us about that. But there's certain situations where the church can reach more than one decision, and it still be a proper decision that doesn't violate anything in the scriptures. But he doesn't even tell the church exactly what to do. He just says to tell it to the church. And the idea is that it's the church's business on how to handle that within the bounds of what the scripture says. But he says, but if he neglect to hear the church, if this person is unwilling to submit themselves to the authority of the church, then he says, let him be unto thee as an heathen man and a publican. In other words, then at that point, that person is to be turned out of the church or excluded from the church. And they're to, it doesn't mean that you're not to love them and to treat them with kindness and charity, but it means that that person no longer has the privileges that come with membership in the Lord's church and the fellowship that comes along with that. In other words, they can't partake of the Lord's Supper and things like that. They're no longer, as long as they're in that state of unrepentance, they don't have that degree of church fellowship. But he says in verses 18 and 19, he says, verily I say unto you, that whatsoever ye shall bind on earth shall be bound in heaven, and whatsoever ye shall loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven. And I say unto you, that if two of you shall agree on earth as touching anything that they shall ask, it shall be done for them of my Father which is in heaven. For where two or three are gathered together in my name, there am I in the midst of them. Jesus says that whatsoever ye shall bind on earth shall be bound in heaven, and whatsoever ye shall loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven. I think, in other words, what Jesus is saying here is when the church is acting in accordance with the will of God and in accordance with the scriptures in matters of church discipline, like we've just read about here, if the church is acting in accordance with the will of God and in accordance with the scriptures, then the decisions of the church carry the authority of heaven. It's as if heaven is ratifying the decisions of the church. The decisions of the church are authoritative, in other words, as long as they're done in accordance with the scriptures. That doesn't mean everything the church does or every decision that every church makes is always right. But when the church is acting in the will of God and in accordance with the scriptures in those situations of church discipline, it's authoritative. That's what Jesus is saying here. Then in verse 21, it says, then came Peter to him and said, Lord, how oft shall my brother sin against me, and I forgive him? Till seven times? Now, Peter was usually the first one to speak up, and very often when he did, he stuck his foot in his mouth. And Peter was the first one to speak up here, and after he hears Jesus say all this about how we're to resolve problems and deal with trespasses and how we should handle it when a sheep goes astray, Peter asked this question. He says, how oft shall my brother sin against me and I forgive him? Till seven times. Now, Peter probably thought he was being extremely generous by being willing to forgive his brother seven times. He probably thought that he was being just extremely forgiving by being willing to forgive somebody who sinned against him seven times. because according to what I've read, the rabbis taught that it was commonly taught in that day that you should forgive somebody up to three times. It may have been four times, but I think it was you're supposed to forgive somebody three times. And then after that, you really shouldn't forgive them anymore because you're just enabling their sin. You're just enabling their behavior if you're continuing to forgive them after they've sinned against you three times. In other words, the idea was, well, if you keep forgiving them after that, you're just part of the problem. You're just letting them do it. Well, first of all, that's a misunderstanding what forgiveness is. And I want to say this, that sometimes these verses have been used in order to excuse or to try to sweep situations of harm or abuse under the rug. But when Jesus says, and he'll say in the next verse, not to forgive seven times, but until 70 times seven. In other words, not just forgive somebody seven times, forgive them 70 times seven. Forgive them 490 times. And I don't think that just means forgive them 490 times, and if they forgive you, if they sin against you 491 times, and that's it. I think that's just Jesus' way of saying you're to forgive without limits. You're to forgive them beyond what anybody else would think is reasonable. But when the rabbis taught that you should only forgive somebody three times, and beyond that is you're just enabling the problem. Well, that misunderstands forgiveness. When Jesus says to forgive your brother who sinned against you 70 times 7, he's not saying that if somebody is harming you, if somebody is putting you in an abusive situation or a situation where you're in harm's way or in danger, that there shouldn't be consequences for that person, or that you should just sit there and take it. That's not what Jesus is saying. You can forgive that person and still report that person to the authorities. You can forgive that person and still have consequences. You can forgive that person and still bring them before the church. Forgiveness and accountability, or forgiveness and consequences, and forgiveness in the law are not, those things are not mutually exclusive. So Jesus is not saying here that if somebody's harming you or abusing you, that by forgiving them that you're supposed to just let that person continue to harm you or somebody else. But he's saying that you're still to forgive them. A person can face consequences for their actions, for breaking the law or doing something that's hurting somebody else, and you can still forgive that person. Jesus says to forgive them until 70 times 7, not just 7 times. And then Jesus tells a story here to illustrate this point, and I'll be very brief with this. I realize we're running out of time, so I'll be brief with this. But Jesus tells this story to illustrate that point. He says, "Therefore is the kingdom of heaven likened unto a certain king which would take account of his servants. And when he had begun to reckon, one was brought unto him which owed him 10,000 talents. But for as much as he had not to pay, his Lord commanded him to be sold, and his wife and children and all that he had, and payment to be made." So this king is taking account of his servants. He's surveying his kingdom. And when he begins to kind of to count up all of his finances, he realizes that there's a large sum of money that was missing. And there was this one servant who was responsible for that money. And it says that this servant owed him 10,000 talents. So we're not talking about just a small amount of money. You know, whenever you look at monetary amounts in the Bible and you try to figure out what that would be worth today, it's very tricky, because not only do you have to deal with inflation and converting another country's currency into today's currency, and then what that would be over 2,000 years later, it's really difficult to figure out exactly what that would be. But we're talking about a sum of probably hundreds of millions, if not billions, of dollars in today's money. We're just talking about a massive amount of money that this servant has probably squandered away. Not just this king's personal money, but the money that belonged to this whole kingdom. He squandered away the whole treasury of this nation. So the king decides that this servant has to be sold, and his wife and children separated from him and sold, and all that he had was to be sold, that payment should be made. But then it says that the servant therefore fell down and worshiped him, saying, "Lord, have patience with me, and I will pay thee all." Now, when you think about the amount of money that this servant owed, there was really no way that servant could have ever paid all. I mean, the idea that this servant said, "Just have patience with me, and I will pay thee all," he knew, and the king knew, that there was no way that man could possibly live long enough to repay everything that he owed. But even so, it says that the Lord of that servant was moved with compassion and loosed him and forgave the debt. That king forgave that debt of hundreds of millions or possibly billions of dollars and just wiped it clean, just forgave the debt entirely and set that servant free. You know, that's what Jesus Christ has done for us. We owed a debt that we could have never repaid. The absurdity of that man's statement when he said, "Have patience with me and I will pay thee all," you know, that statement was just as absurd as we would be if we thought that we could do anything to earn our salvation, or to earn God's forgiveness, or to pay off the sin debt that we owed against God. There's no way that we could have ever paid the sin debt that we owed, but Jesus Christ was moved with compassion and loosed us and forgave our debt. He paid the debt with his own blood in order that we could be forgiven the debt that we could never pay. And so that servant was set free. He was forgiven that debt. But then it says, the same servant went out and found one of his fellow servants which owed him 100 pence. Now this man has just been forgiven hundreds of millions of dollars, probably. And the first thing he does when he is forgiven his debt and set free is he goes out and he finds his fellow servant, somebody who's a servant just like him, somebody who owed him 100 pence. And it says that he laid hands on him and took him by the throat, saying, "Pay me that thou owest." He goes out and finds this man who owes him 100 pence. Now, 100 pence is not chump change. I mean, we're not talking about just pocket change here. It's not an insignificant amount of money, but it's relatively small. In fact, compared to what this man had just been forgiven, 100 pence was nothing. But this man who has just been forgiven this massive debt goes out, and the first thing he does is he finds somebody who owes him 100 pence, and he takes him by the throat and begins to shake him down and demand that this man pays him the debt that he owes. I mean, I would think that if you or I had been forgiven a debt that we owed of any amount, much less the amount and the consequences that this man was facing, we'd go out and we would be just walking on air. We would just be just so happy. We wouldn't think about anybody who's done us wrong. But that's the first thing this man thinks about. Rather than enjoying his forgiveness, rather than appreciating the grace and the mercy that was just shown to him, he's not thinking about that. He's not grateful for that. He's going out and shaking down somebody who owes him a relatively small amount of money. And he says, "Pay me that thou owest." And his fellow servant fell down at his feet and besought him, saying, "Have patience with me, and I will pay thee all." Exact same words that first servant said to the king a few verses earlier. He says, "Have patience with me, and I will pay thee all." But he says, and he would not. He was unwilling to have any patience or any mercy whatsoever. But he went and cast him into prison till he should pay the debt. And when his fellow servants saw what was done, they were very sorry and came and told unto their Lord all that was done. Then his Lord, after that he had called him, said unto him, "O thou wicked servant, I forgave thee all that debt because thou desirest me. Shouldest not thou also have had compassion on thy fellow servant, even as I had pity on thee?" He says, after I've forgiven you this massive debt that you owed, you weren't willing to show even a fraction of that mercy and forgiveness to your fellow servant who owed you just a little bit of money. And it says, "And his Lord was wroth and delivered him to the tormentors till he should pay all that was due unto him. So likewise shall my heavenly Father do also unto you, if ye from your hearts forgive not every one his brother their trespasses." You know, that's very similar to the language Jesus uses in the model prayer when he teaches us how to pray, and he says that when we pray that we should ask God to forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. Yeah. We don't have any more right to ask God to forgive us than we're willing to forgive those who trespass against us. Well, we shouldn't have the audacity to ask God to forgive us our trespasses if we're not willing to forgive others who trespass against us. But you know, I realize that's easier said than done. It's easy to read this passage and to say that we should just be willing to forgive one another. You know, when we read all of that earlier about how to deal with offenses in the church and how we're to try to resolve those problems and to forgive one another, that's easier said than done. I think we all know that by experience. That's easy to say, but when it actually happens, it can be hard to do. But what Jesus has just illustrated here through this parable is that the way to forgive one another, the way to be more forgiving, is not just to go through the motions, or not just to try to force ourselves to forgive, But the way to be more forgiving is to realize and to constantly keep it in the front of our minds just how much God has forgiven us. You know, Paul said in Ephesians chapter 4, he said to be kind, tender-hearted, forgiving one another as God for Christ's sake hath forgiven you. The more we'll realize how much God for Christ's sake has forgiven us, the easier it'll be to be kind and tender-hearted and forgive one another. There's a story I heard years ago, and it's always stuck with me, that I think about when I think about this passage. I read about somebody who was in doing some work in the jungles of South America, I think. It was told as a true story. I don't know if it was. But there were leeches that were common in this area. And this man, you know, had going through the jungles, had accumulated leeches all over his body. And he was just covered in leeches, and he tried to pull them off. And the harder he pulled against those leeches, the harder they you know, sucked on him and clung harder to him. The harder he tried to yank the leeches off, the harder they clung, and the harder it was to get rid of those leeches. And so some of the natives showed that man and said, "There's a warm spring over here, and if you'll go and you'll bathe in that warm spring, then those leeches will just begin to fall off. If you keep plucking at them, it'll get worse. But if you'll go bathe in this warm spring, those leeches will just begin to just naturally fall off." And the point of that story, as I heard it told, was that's how the love and the forgiveness of God is for us. If we just try to forgive one another by just trying to force ourselves to forgive and just go through the motions without realizing the why it is we're to forgive one another, without realizing how much God for Christ's sake hath forgiven us, then those grudges and those problems will just get deeper and deeper, and we'll never be able to resolve them. But if we'll bathe ourselves in the mercy and the love and the forgiveness of God in Jesus Christ, the way that man bathed himself in those warm springs, those leeches of unforgiveness, so to speak, will just begin to fall off the more we'll appreciate and bask in the love and the forgiveness of God. I appreciate your good patience and attention. May God bless you.